Hello and welcome to this week's Friday News Feedbag. I'm your host, Will Johnson, and we're joined, as always, by Discovery News reporters James Williams and Jorge Ribas. James, how are you?
I am great. Thanks, Will. How are you?
Doing well. And Jorge?
I'm doing good. And you?
I'm great. And you guys are both in your remote locations today.
We are, yep. The bunker.
The bunker? Is that what you call it?
The news bunker.
The news bunker. How are things in the news bunker?
Comfy.
Lots of good stories lined up for us.
We have a couch. Yep.
Is that right?
No.
Cans.
Should put one back here.
That would be nice.
Cans of dry goods and
yeah.
preparing for anything.
Right.
All right. Well, let me tell our listeners how this works. Our new listeners, our old listeners, or I don't want to call them old, our what do you call them? Our regular subscribers, I guess.
Classic.
Old school. Yeah. Classic. That's good.
They already know how it works. But basically, every week, James brings us three stories. Jorge brings us three stories. These are Discovery News stories in the realms of science, technology, health, medicine, you name it. And they tell us about the stories. And then you, the listener, gets to vote on your favorite one. It doesn't matter why you like it. Well, it matters. But, you know, you can base your decision on anything. And then we keep sort of a running tally here to let you know how this little contest is going. James and Jorge, what's the current score? I have to ask you this every week.
Jorge has 13, and I have 12.
All right. Well, so James has a chance to tie it up again this week, and we will bring you the all new stories for the week in just a minute. But first of all, let's reveal the results from last week's feedback. Guys, first of all, I'm going to read a few of the emails, and this will probably give you an indication of what the winning story was. Let's see here. From New York, this listener writes in, "My vote this week is for James' wonderful story about honey. By the way, I was going to vote for one of James' stories no matter what because James is the best and his stories rule. I always vote for James' stories."
James, you cannot write emails to yourself.
Yeah,
we've already laid that ground rule.
Really?
Anybody can set up these email accounts.
I swear I don't know that. I did not write that email.
All right, here's another one. "Will, James, and Jorge, I'm putting in my vote for Article of the Week." They call it Article of the Week, as the article on honey. "Although the presentation of the data left the listener with the impression that they could go out to their local grocery store and purchase honey to treat wounds, I thought it did a good job of making the general listener aware of the topic." So let's just be clear on that. Was this your story, James? Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
I guess you can't just go to the store and buy honey, right? It was last
week. He tried. I don't know. All right. You know what? It didn't say. I guess you're right. Yeah, you probably can't.
Well,
I mean, let's just say this. Before you tried it, you'd want to consult a medical professional.
I mean, these are stories that, you know, other people have worked on, and we're just sharing. We're sharing what they've done. So
right.
Don't necessarily run out and do it. And this person also writes, "Although I'm sure you realize that the antibacterial properties of honey is affected by the source of the nectar," they also sent along some good links with more info. So I'll send those to you, James.
All right, thank you.
He also wrote, I have to admit, a non-scientific basis. I had to vote for someone who is a Wolverine fan, James.
All right.
So that actually helped you out.
Nice.
And, you know what, well, here's another one. "I'm going to have to go with the story about the healing properties of honey, though the mere mention of Wolverine in the sea cucumber story also had me pick that one."
Nice.
So.
That's because, seriously, Wolverine, number one superhero.
All right, and then finally another one here from Andy. "I wanted to vote for the honey story. The reason, well, honey is delicious."
So true.
So, that Jorge, I guess you know who won. James.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, James wins for the honey story. So congratulations, James.
That was a good story, though.
Well, thank you. Thank you for voting for me.
And those were just a few of the emails, but it was sort of overwhelming. Definitely a vote for the honey story. Also, your story about the continent moving fast or slow, or India being like the fast kind.
Oh, yeah, I think that was mine.
That had a vote, and the sea cucumber vote had some, or sea cucumber story had some votes too. But honey won by landslide. So congratulations,
cool.
James. Score now tied up 13-all.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's see what happens this week. Jorge, you want to take it away?
I will.
Okay,
my first story comes out of the journal Current Biology, where researchers are studying daylight savings time and how it affects our internal clocks and our daily rhythms. And what they found is that we don't adjust to it as well as past studies have indicated that, you know, after a few days our sleeping patterns adjust. But what they said, it actually impacts us deeper than that and really affects our behavior and our physiology. And, you know, like any other animals, we have like a circadian clock that uses daylight to stay in synchrony with the environment as the seasons change. And this is so, I guess it's so innate in us that it adjusts to the east-west progression of dawn within any given time zone. And when we adjust for daylight savings time, our body doesn't click with it as well. And they did this by studying 55,000 people in Central Europe, and they did a survey, and they took you know, everyone's kind of own natural clock preferences or chronotypes into it.
Okay, I'm sorry. Did you say 55,000?
55,000.
Is that everyone in Central
that's
Europe?
All of Central Europe.
Well, that's Luxembourg, isn't it?
But they took everyone's, you know, natural clock preferences. And, you know, they actually, you know, they have a name for whether you're a morning person or a night person. I'm definitely a night person. I always thought I was just lazy in the morning, but I'm a chronotype.
How do you stay? How late do you stay up?
I stay up pretty late. I can stay up till like, I don't know, midnight or 1.
Oh, wow.
I just don't really get tired, but my mornings are rough. Maybe that's why. But anyway, so yeah. I'm a late person chronotype. And they found that the timing of both sleep and peak activity levels will readily adjust to the release of daylight savings time, which is in the autumn. But that the timing of the activity of, you know, of like your activeness and your sleep doesn't adjust to the start of it in the spring. And basically, this guy's quote is, it's in effect, it's as if the entire population of Germany, which is pretty much like all the people they did for the survey, is transported to Morocco in the spring and back again in the autumn. So what they're saying is basically, we just don't adjust to this stuff as well. And they're wondering if whether, you know, on just like, you know, while it's nice to have that extra hour of daylight, you know, it actually harms our body behaviors.
I didn't get the whole transportation thing to Morocco.
I didn't really either, and I thought that was kind of like, you know, when they kind of say something to get everyone's...
Do you think, I'll bet Morocco is nice in the spring.
I would go to Morocco. I mean, I bet, you know, I don't know if...
Someone wants to send me to Morocco in the spring.
to test this. So, I don't know. Maybe we should relook at daylight savings time.
All right, that's interesting. Because you think most of us are pretty happy, at least, in the summer days where it's light in the evening.
Well, I'll tell you, not to discount the study at all, but I don't even know if right now if the clock's ahead or if it's normal. Like, do you guys notice at all?
That's because we're in an office with fluorescent lights all day.
Yeah, I mean, really, like,
well, it's never normal. Day. Half the year it's one way, and half the year it's the other.
No, but are we normal right now or no?
What is normal?
Like, not the daylight.
That's a very good question. What is normal?
Why be normal?
Yeah. So you just not only did you discount the study, but you discounted 55,000 people.
Hey, I am who I am, man.
All right, James, take it away for your first story of the week.
All right, my first story, this is to answer all those questions you ever had when you were sitting in math class saying, when will I ever use this in real life, is right now. This is out of the University of Southern California, where a researcher there has written a paper that won best paper for 2007 from the Institute for Operations Research and Management Science Transportation Science and Logistics Society.
What?
Yes, it's very exciting, Will. And what he did is used an algorithm to figure out how much slack bus schedules should include in order to keep their operations from bunching up and to make it the most efficient bus route possible. So he figured out It turns out it's 15% to 20% slack time. So what the formula says basically is that if you should include a 15% to 20% like buffer zone in your bus trip, in the route, when you plan out the route, give yourself an extra 15% to 20% extra time to complete it, and that's the most efficient way to have a schedule. And he said right now no one's using this new algorithm on their schedules yet, no transit system is, but their next step is to make agency aware that there is, like, this is the best way to do it. Because right now they use these, you know, it's sort of a rule of thumb, like the way it's always been done, and this guy is like, hey, I'm going to drop some math on the problem. Here's the solution. This is why it was worth paying attention.
We can use
this
that
guy
here.
Drop the same algorithm and solve the problem of, because I don't know about the buses, cause I don't take bus that much, but I know for airplanes, it'd be nice to figure out what the buffer zone for delayed airplanes are. So maybe it's like 4 to 6 hours instead of 15 minutes.
You know what? Before today, I would have said no way, but I would not be surprised if they're not going to use math to combat that as well.
They must already for air travel somehow.
I don't know. They probably do.
I don't know. Have you flown lately? I think they just kind of tell you when you get there.
Can you guys not say dropping algorithms anymore?
Dropping algorithms? Not.
You want us to drop
it? Say it more often.
Yeah, drop it. Drop it.
dropping algorithms?
Yes.
All right. Okay.
All right, James. Interesting. So why math is useful?
Yep.
Okay. Jorge, story number two.
Cool. I got a sort of a similar story, but it's a little bit different. But this one comes out of the International Journal for Logistics, systems and management. And researchers in the study found a new approach to cutting journey times for courier services, so delivery trucks and everything that are trying to figure out the best possible method for you know, delivering items. So,
I have an algorithm, actually, I could drop on
you,
that.
You drop an algorithm on that? And in this study, through this computational research, they found that what they called the vehicle routing problem, and it's basically so like every morning, you know, when these delivery trucks go out, they have 10 stops they have to make, and those are stuff that's already in their computer. And over the course of the day, they might have like 10 more stops might get added onto their routes, and it's the job of the dispatcher or whatever to think of the best routes for these trucks that are already kind of going from place to place to take. And this new computer model would essentially like reroute the whole trip. So instead of just plugging in a stop, so if they have to make, kind of plugging in a stop in between two stops they already have, it'll like sort of wipe their whole delivery day clean and start over from scratch to find out what the best route for the truck to take, the most effective and the fuel effective, I guess. And that's really the basis of the studies, is cutting down on costs, especially, for, greener delivery and things that using less fuel during the course of the day.
That's a moneymaker.
Yeah.
I mean, you're coming up with a more efficient way of doing business, I think,
Right. I mean, for everybody. And they said, it's something that right now they're testing on couriers, but it could be used for anything, from like, those kind of dollar ride services that you get at the airport to, emergency services, fire, police, ambulance, even like, I think, pizza delivery guys. I used to deliver pizzas. And
is that right?
Pretty sweet.
Was that after or before you were doing the grocery cart?
That was, it was after grocery cart.
Okay.
Before Discovery Channel.
Yep.
Somewhere in the middle there, I was a pizza delivery guy.
That seems like way overdue.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, I
had that. That should have been like invented shortly. I don't know, like after the first delivery was ever made.
Yeah, there must be something like that in place. Like the larger delivery companies can't just have some guy sitting back at home with a map, Yeah, go to Kansas.
Like a protractor.
Yeah, putting push pins in a map and being like, oh, this looks, and like a string between each push pin kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm looking at Missouri right now, and it looks like.
I guess that the what they say is that is a, there's technology like this available, but I guess the idea of doing it in real time and faster and reroute this stuff like immediately as soon as orders come in is what is novel about the idea.
Huh.
That's cool. Well, good. I'm glad they're finally getting to it.
All right, Jorge. Interesting study. Two stories on schedules and delivery in a way.
Yeah.
All right. James, your second story?
Yep, my second story is from the University of Virginia, and it's published this month in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. And what these folks did is they surveyed 350 college students in Japan, Korea, and the United States over a three-week period, and they found that European Americans, which I'm assuming are like, Americans who have European descent, like, Irish, German, whatever, are claimed to be happier in general than Asian Americans or Koreans or Japanese. But while they claim to be happier, they are more easily made less happy by negative events and recover at a slower rate from negative events than their Asian or Asian-descended counterparts.
Hmm.
So,
because they're already not as happy.
It's like there's like a difference in the baseline, I guess. Like the European Americans have like they basically, when something bad happens to them, like say like they get a parking ticket or something, they need nearly two positive events to kind of bring them back up to their baseline, their normal level of happiness,
which is kind of high compared
than like the Koreans, the Japanese, or the Asian Americans, who only need one positive event to get right back there. So I think it's like,
what's better?
I don't know. Yeah, is it worth it? I mean, the comparison that they give is that like the person who's used to flying first class and becomes annoyed if there's a half hour delay is much more annoyed than the person who flies economy and just sort of accepts the delay in stride.
So European Americans are spoiled.
Yeah.
That's
what they're basically saying.
What it comes down to.
Yeah.
Just using your example, so I got a parking ticket for $50.
Right.
And on my way back, let's say I was of Asian descent, and on my way back I found $50 on the street,
right,
I would be happy. But if for a European American getting a parking ticket for $50, they'd have to find $100.
Or $50, and then like or somebody is like, hey, here's a free ice cream cone.
Or what about $25 in one place and then $25?
You know, I don't know.
I think Jorge's example is terrible.
I don't know. You guys just completely threw me off.
Yeah, like what is a positive event? I guess is what. We're asking.
Well, I don't know. But basically, what the advice of the researcher is don't try to be happier. Like, yeah, be like happy and be able to roll with the punches.
A little more even keeled.
Yeah, exactly.
We're all walking around with these.
I guess that's
big smiles.
The ultimate question, though, and we could ask our readers: is would you rather be happier
listeners
or be not as happy but able to recover from bad events quicker?
Honestly, I sort of think that the Asian way of doing it is a little bit more realistic. You end up at least being less cranky, I would think.
Yeah, yeah. So. All right, interesting story. Let's take it back to Jorge, story number three.
Okay, my last story comes out of Johns Hopkins, where researchers have found that tiny hair-like cell structures that are known as cilia, which, you know, they've known the cilia affects some of our other senses, like vision, hearing, and smell. What they found is that it actually also helps form our sense of touch. And I always think it's kind of interesting that, you know, we've obviously had the sense of touch for pretty long time. And,
and very long time.
How exactly it is we have this sense and where it comes from, and just kind of figuring out, oh, it's from these little tiny hair-like projections that are on the surface of our cells. And they found this by taking, I guess, both people and mice that are lacking or have defective cilia. And the condition in people is called, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this totally right, but it's Bardet-Biedl syndrome, or BBS. And then the mice, they engineered them genetically to have defective cilia. And what they did to test heat sensitivity is they would immerse the tails of the mice in warm water, in hot to warm water, and then measured how long it took for the mice to flick their tails. And they did the same thing on a mechanical side, is by putting increasing, but they made sure not painful pressure to the hind feet of the mice until they withdrew their paws. And in both times, the mice that had the defective cilia, or these little tails on their cells, didn't respond as quickly as a mouse that had, you know, normal acting cilia. And the same, they did similar tests to people, where they would use a tuning fork on their wrist and you know, have them guess like the weight or the shape of the object by feeling it. And then they found that the people with the BBS, which is this syndrome, didn't respond as well as people without it. So, you know, it's learning something new, I guess, about how we touch things.
So wait, what's the thrust of that then?
I love how James finds a way to bring your story down.
No. I'm just trying to understand it because he just threw out a lot of.
Yeah, I talked for a while there.
What was the middle part?
No, but I'm trying to understand what was it that they're trying to understand how it is that we get.
Where our sense of touch, how it's developed and where it comes from. You know, And finding out what affects it. You know what I mean? I know that there's people out there that don't have the sense of touch, which I think is weird, or are affected by it by having these defective cilia. I guess it's really just studying how we sense touch and heat and pain and things like that.
So are they're looking at how small you have to go to find the origins of where sense of touch comes from?
Exactly.
Oh wow. It starts
on a structure that's smaller than, you know, than a human cell, I guess, on our skin.
Wow.
Who are the researchers on this again?
What's that?
Who's the researchers on this again?
Johns Hopkins.
Yeah, maybe they're
reputable.
Yeah, they could maybe give us a call and clear up some of this.
Actually, that wouldn't be that bad.
Our apologies. All right, well, let's take it back to James for his third and final story. Thank you, Jorge.
Sure. Okay, my last story is from the Association of Psychological Science, and this is, I think, a really cool story because it's something that all of us have to think about at some point, and that's the inevitability of death. And what they looked at is, because the prospect of death is there and it's so incomprehensible, how is it that we are able to do anything? How is it that we're able to just live our lives and not be stuck in the fetal position in the corner crying over the terror of the fact that we're all going to die, right?
Happy Friday, everyone.
I know, but it's pretty cool. There's an emerging idea called terror management theory, which basically says that the brain is hardwired to keep us with it, to keep us, you know, cognizant here and plugged in to the world and not be paralyzed by our fear. So in order to test this out, they ran three experiments to study existential dread in the laboratory. And so they got these volunteers to think about what happens physically as they die and to imagine what it would be like to be dead. And while they were preoccupied with these thoughts, they completed a series of word tests that they want to use to tap into the unconscious emotion. So they would do a word stem. They started, like, say, J-O, and then the person had to make a word out of those first two letters. And so the people could do something neutral like job or jog, or they might instead opt for a more emotional word like joy.
Or Jorge,
exactly. They would flash a puppy on this, the word puppy on the screen, and then people would instantly have to choose between beetle or parade as the best match. The beetle is closer to the puppy because they're both animals, but the parade is closer to the puppy in emotional content. And so they were saying that how these people made those choices would represent the unconscious mind at work. And what they found, people were much more likely to summon up positive emotional associations rather than neutral or negative ones. And what they say is that the brain is involuntarily searching out and activating pleasant positive information from memory banks in order to help the brain cope with this threat of death. So basically, like, your brain kind of steps in before you start freaking out and says, hey, look. Here's a puppy.
Yeah. Like a puppy parade.
Yeah, exactly. That's how it is that we're all able to
to wake up,
get on with things.
That's actually really interesting.
Yeah, your brain does a whole lot for you, which I'm so glad. But the nice thing is, like, here's a little bit extra. It keeps you from freaking out all the time.
Keeps you.
I have a different way of coping with death. It's just I'm going to cryogenically freeze myself.
Cryogenically.
What did I say? Cryogenic?
Yeah.
It's all right.
All right. Cryogenically.
That's another option, so don't even worry about the puppy parade.
Jorge gets through life confident that he will never die.
Yeah, that's how I get through it. But I like the idea that your brain is like, you're freaking out, and your brain's just like, hey, look at the puppy.
Yeah.
It's kind of like your brain is like your parent.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right.
There's nothing to be worried about. Happy.
All right, guys. Well, I guess that's it for the stories of the week. We'll invite our listeners to email us or call us. But first of all, let's do a quick recap. Jorge, you want to tell us your stories?
Yeah.
For people who've already forgotten,
All right. I've actually already forgotten. My first story was that the daylight savings time actually disrupts us more than we know. That my second story was a computer solution to delivery problems. And my final story was how our cilia in our cells help us with our sense of touch.
And my stories are using math to make better bus routes. Don't be too happy, and don't worry. You're able to get through life without being always afraid of death because your brain makes you think of puppies.
I hate this is not really fair. Although people probably don't care what I say, but I mean, how can you pick a bus route story over the story about how we stay happy with the prospect of death?
Yeah.
If you're a mathematician, you will.
That's true, yeah. All right.
Or if you're cryogenically freezing yourself and you don't really matter. It doesn't matter anyway.
And you're also a bus driver.
All right, well, let me remind our listeners how to get in touch with us. Please send us your vote and why you like the story of the week. The email is pod_cast@discovery.com. That's pod_cast@discovery.com. Or call us. Leave us a message at 888-890-6339. 888-890-6339. That's it, guys.
All right, great.
Another week wrapped up. We'll talk to you next week. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Will.
Thanks, you too.
And for the Friday News Feedback and Discovery News, I'm Will Johnson.